mouth above. The eyes. I don't think those are quite right, she said, peering into his hand. Working so small. I couldn't get the colour exactly. Dars were much easier. Blues just were easier. A tiny dab of cobalt, highlighted with white, and that faint green shadow that intensified the blue while vanishing itself. Well, and that was Dar, too. Strong, vivid, and straightforward. To get a brown with true depth and subtlety, though, let alone something that even approximated the smoky topaz of her mother's eyes, always clear, but changing like the light on a peat-brown trout stream. That needed more underpainting than was really possible in the tiny space of a miniature. She'd have to try again sometime, with a larger portrait. Are they like, do you think? They're wonderful. Ian looked from one to the other. Then he put the portrait of Claire gently back into its place. Have your parents seen them yet? No. I wanted to be sure they were right before I show them to anybody. But if they are, I'm thinking I can show them to the people who come to sit and maybe get commissions for more miniatures. Those I could work on at home on the ridge. All I'd need is my paint box and the little ivory discs. I could do the painting from the sketches. I wouldn't need the sitter to keep coming. She made a brief explanatory gesture toward the large canvas she was working on, which showed Farquhar Campbell looking rather like a stuffed ferret in his best suit, surrounded by numerous children and grandchildren, most of these mere whitish blobs at the moment. Her strategy was to have their mothers drag the small ones in one at a time, to have each child's limbs and features hastily sketched into the appropriate blob before natural wriggliness or tantrums obtruded. Ian glanced at the canvas, but his attention returned to the miniatures of her parent. He stood looking at them, a slight smile on his long, half-homely face. Then, feeling her eyes on him, he glanced up, alarmed.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, come on, Ian. Let me just sketch you, she coaxed. It won't hurt, you know.
Ugh, that's what you think, he countered,
backing away as though the pencil she had taken up might be a weapon.
The Ganyan Kahaga think to have a likeness of someone gives you power over them. That's why the Medicine Society wear false faces, so the demons causing the illness will not have their true likeness and will not ken who to hurt, aye?
This was said in such a serious tone that she squinted at him to see whether he was joking. He didn't seem to be. Ian, Mama explained to you about germs, didn't she?
Aye, she did, of course, he said,
in a tone exhibiting no conviction at all.
She showed me things swimming about and said they were living in my teeth.
His face showed momentary repugnance at the notion, but he left the matter to return to the subject at hand.
There was a travelling Frenchman came to the village once, a natural philosopher. He'd drawings he'd made of birds and animals, and that astonished them. But then he made the mistake of offering to make a likeness of the war chief's wife. I barely got him out in one piece.
But you aren't a Mohawk, she said patiently. And if you were, you're not afraid of me having power over you, are you? He turned his head and gave her a sudden queer look that went through her like a knife through butter.
No, he said. No, of course not.
But his voice had little more conviction than when discussing germs. Still, he moved to the stool she kept for sitters, set in a good light from the open doors that led to the terrace, and sat down, chin lifted and jaw set like one about to be heroically executed. Suppressing a smile, she took up the sketching block and drew as quickly as she could, lest he change his mind. It was a difficult subject. His features lacked the solid, clear-cut bone structure that both her parents and Roger had. And yet, it was in no way a soft face, even discounting the stippled tattoos that curved from the bridge of his nose across his cheeks. Young and fresh, and yet the firmness of his mouth. It was slightly crooked, she saw with interest. How had she never noticed that before? Belonged to someone much older,
bracketed by lines that would cut much deeper with age, but were already firmly entrenched. The eyes. She despaired of getting those right. Large and hazel, they were his one claim to beauty, and yet beautiful was the last thing you would call them. Like most eyes, they weren't one colour at all, but many. The colours of autumn, dark, wet earth, and crackling oak leaves, and the touch of setting sun on dry grass. The colour was a challenge, but one she could meet. The expression, though, it changed in an instant from something so guilelessly amiable as to seem almost half-witted, to something you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley. The expression at present was somewhere between these two extremes, but shifted suddenly toward the latter as his attention focused on the open doors behind her and the terrace beyond. She glanced over her shoulder, startled. Someone was there. She saw the edge of his or her shadow, but the person who threw it was keeping out of sight. Whoever it was began to whistle, a tentative, breathy sound. For an instant, everything was normal. Then the world shifted. The intruder was whistling Yellow Submarine. All the blood rushed from her head and she swayed, grabbing the edge of an occasional table to keep from falling. Dimly, she sensed Ian rising like a cat from his stool, seizing one of her palette knives, and sliding noiselessly out of the room into the hallway. Her hands had gone cold and numb, so had her lips. She tried to whistle a phrase in reply, but nothing but a little air emerged. Straightening up, she took hold of herself and sang the last few words instead. She could barely manage the tune, but there was no doubt of the words. Dead silence from the terrace. The whistling had stopped. "Who are you?" she said clearly. "Come in." The shadow lengthened slowly, showing a head like a lion's, light shining through the curls, glowing on the terrace stones. The head itself poked cautiously into sight around the corner of the door. It was an Indian, she saw with astonishment, though his dress was mostly European, and ragged, bar a wampum necklet. He was lean and dirty, with close-set eyes, which were fixed on her with eagerness, and something like avidity. "You alone, man?" he asked in a hoarse whisper. "Thought I heard voices."
"You can see I am. Who on earth are you?"
Wendigo. Wendigo Donner. Your name's Fraser, right?" He had edged all the way into the room now, though still glancing warily from side to side. "My maiden name, yes. Are you?" She stopped, not sure how to ask. "Yeah," he said softly, looking her up and down in a casual way that no man of the 18th century would have employed to a lady. "So are you, aren't you? You're her daughter. You have to be."
He spoke with a certain intensity, moving closer. She didn't think he meant her harm. He was just very interested.
Ian didn't wait to see, though. There was a brief darkening of the light from the door, and then he had Donna from behind, the Indian squawk of alarm choked off by the arm across his throat, the point of the palette knife jabbing him under the ear.
"Who are you, arsebite, and what do you want?"
Ian demanded, tightening the arm across Donna's throat. The Indian's eyes bulged, and he made small, mewling noises.
"How do you expect him to answer you if you're choking him?"
This appeal to reason caused Ian to relax his grip, albeit reluctantly. Donna coughed, rubbing his throat ostentatiously, and shot Ian a resentful look.
"No need for that, man. I wasn't doing nothing to her."
Donna's eyes went from her to Ian and back. He jerked his head toward Ian.
"Is he?"
"No, but he knows. Sit down.
You met my mother when she... when she was kidnapped, didn't you?" Ian's feathery brows shot up at this, and he took a firmer grip on the palette knife, which was flexible, but had a definite point.
"Yeah."
Donna lowered himself gingerly onto the stool, keeping a wary eye on Ian.
"Man, they nearly got me. Your mother, she told me her old man was gnarly, and I didn't want to be there when he showed up, but I didn't believe her."
Almost, I didn't. When I heard those drums, man, I bugged out, and a damn good thing I did, too.
He swallowed, looking pale.
I went back in the morning. Jeez, man.
Ian said something under his breath in what Brianna thought was Mohawk. It sounded unfriendly in the extreme, and Donna evidently discerned enough of the meaning to make him scoot his stool a little further away, hunching his shoulders.
Hey, man, I didn't do nothing to her, okay?
He looked pleadingly at Brianna.
I didn't. I was going to help her get away. Ask her, she'll tell you. Only Fraser and his guy showed up before I could. Christ, why would I hurt her? She's the first one I found back here. I ain't needed her.
The first one, Ian said, frowning.
The first traveller, he means, Brianna said. Her heart was beating fast. What did you need her for?
To tell me how to get back.
He swallowed again, his hand going to the wampum ornament around his neck.
Did you come through, or were you born here? I'm figuring you came through, he added, not waiting for an answer. They don't grow 'em as big as you now, little bitty girls. Me, I like a big woman.
He smiled in what he plainly intended to be an ingratiating manner.
I came, Brianna said shortly.
What the hell are you doing here?
Trying to get close enough to talk to your mother.
He glanced uneasily over his shoulder. There were slaves in the kitchen garden, their voices audible.
I hid out with a Cherokee for a while, and I figured to come down and talk to her at Fraser's Ridge when it was safe. But the old lady there told me you were all down here. I have a long way to walk, he added, looking vaguely resentful. But then that big black dude ran me off twice when I tried to get in before. Guess I didn't meet the dress code.
His face flickered, not quite managing a smile.
I've been sneaking around for the last 3 days trying to catch a glimpse of her, find her alone outside. But I saw her talking to you out on the terrace and heard you call her Mama. Seeing how big you are, I figured you must be... Well, I figured if you didn't pick up on the song, no harm done, huh? So, you want to go back where you came from, do you?
Ian asked. Plainly, he thought this was an excellent idea.
Oh, yeah, Donna said fervently. Oh, yeah.
Where did you come through? Brianna asked. The shock of his appearance was fading, subsumed by curiosity. In Scotland?
No. Is that where you did it? He asked eagerly.
Scarcely waiting for her nod, he went on.
Your mother said she came and then went back again and came again. Can you all go back and forth like, you know, a revolving door?
Brianna shook her head violently, shuddering in recollection.
God, no. It's horrible. And it's so dangerous, even with a gemstone. Gemstone?
He pounced on that.
You got to have a gemstone to do it.
Not absolutely, but it seems to be some protection. And it may be that there's some way to use gemstones to steer, sort of. But we don't really know about that. She hesitated, wanting to ask more questions, but wanting still more to fetch Claire. Ian, could you go and get Mama? I think she's in the kitchen garden with Fred.
Her cousin gave the visitor a flat, narrow look and shook his head. I'll not leave you alone with this fellow. You go. I'll watch him.
She would have argued, but long experience with Scottish males had taught her to recognise intractable stubbornness when she saw it. Besides, Donna's eyes were fixed on her in a way that made her slightly uncomfortable. He was looking at her hand, she realised, at the cabochon ruby in her ring. She was reasonably sure she could fight him off if necessary. But still...
I'll be right back, she said, hastily stabbing a neglected brush into the pot of turps. Don't go anywhere.
I was shocked, but less so than I might have been. I had felt that Donna was alive. Hoped he was, in spite of everything. Still, seeing him face to face, sitting in Jocasta's morning room, struck me dumb. He was talking when I came in, but stopped when he saw me. He didn't stand up, naturally, nor yet offer any observations on my survival, just nodded at me, and resumed what he'd been saying. To stop Whitey. Save our land, save our people.
But you came to the wrong time, Brianna pointed out. You were too late.
Donna gave her a blank look.
No, I didn't. 1766, that's when I was supposed to come, and that's when I came.
He pounded the heel of his hand violently against the side of his head.
Crap! What was wrong with me?
Congenital stupidity, I suggested politely, having regained my voice. That, or hallucinogenic drugs?
The blank look flickered a little, and Donna's mouth twitched.
Oh, yeah, man. There was some of that.
But if you came to 1766 and meant to, Bree objected, what about Robert Springer, Ottertooth?
According to the story Mama heard about him, he meant to warn the native tribes against white men and prevent them colonizing the place. Only he arrived too late to do that. And even so, he must have arrived 40 or 50 years before you did.
That wasn't the plan, man, Donna burst out.
He stood up, rubbing both hands violently through his hair in agitation, making it stand out like a bramble bush.
Jeez, no!
Oh, it wasn't.
What the bloody hell was the plan, then? I demanded.
You did have one.
Yeah. Yeah, we did.
He dropped his hands, glancing round as though fearing to be overheard. He licked his lips.
Bob did want to do what you said. Only the rest said, nah, that wouldn't work. Too many different groups. Too much pressure to trade with the Whiteys. Just no way it would fly, you know. We couldn't stop it all, just maybe make it better.
The official plan of the group had been somewhat less ambitious in scope. The travellers would arrive in the 1760s, and over the course of the next 10 years, in the confusion and reshuffling, the movement of tribes and villages attendant upon the end of the French and Indian War would infiltrate themselves into various Indian groups along the treaty line in the colonies and up into the Canadian territories. They would then use such persuasive powers as they had gained to sway the Indian nations to fight on the British side in the oncoming revolution, with the intent of ensuring a British victory.
See, the English, they act like the Indians are sovereign nations, he explained, with a glibness suggesting this was a theory learned by rote. They won, they'd go on doing trade and like that, which is okay, but they wouldn't be trying to push the Indians back and stomp 'em out. The colonists!
He waved scornfully toward the open door.
Greedy sons of bitches been shoving their way into Indian land for the past 100 years. They ain't going to stop.
Bree raised her brows, but I could see that she found the notion intriguing. Evidently it wasn't quite as insane as it sounded.
How could you think you'd succeed? I demanded. Only a few men to...
Oh, my God, I said, seeing his face change. Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ! You weren't the only ones, were you?
Donno shook his head, wordless.
How many?
Ian asked. He sounded calm, but I could see that his hands were clenched on his knees.
I dunno.
Donno sat down abruptly, slumping into himself like a bag of grain.
There were like 200 or 300 in the group, but most of them couldn't hear the stones.
His head lifted a little, and he glanced at Brianna.
Can you?
She nodded, ruddy brows drawn together.
But you think there were more travellers than you and your friends?
Donna shrugged, helpless.
I got the idea there were, yeah. But Raymond said only 5 at a time could pass through. So we trained in, like, cells of 5. We kept it secret. Nobody in the big group knew who could travel and who couldn't. And Raymond was the only one who knew all of them.
I had to ask.
What did Raymond look like?
A possibility had been stirring in the back of my mind ever since I'd heard that name.
Donna blinked, having not expected that question.
Jeez, I don't know,
he said helplessly.
Short dude, I think.
White hair.
Wore it long, like we all did.
He raked a hand through his knotted locks in illustration, brows furrowed in the search for memory.
A rather wide forehead. I knew I oughtn't to prompt him, but couldn't help myself. and drew both index fingers across my own brow in illustration. He stared at me in confusion for a moment.
"Man, I don't remember," he said, shaking his head helplessly. "It was a long time ago. How would I remember something like that?"
I sighed. "Well, tell me what happened when you came through the stones."
Donna licked his lips, blinking in the effort of recall. "It wasn't just native stupidity I saw. He didn't like thinking about it."
"Yeah. Well, there were five of us, like I said. Me and Rob and Jeremy and Atta. Oh, and Jojo. We came through on the island and..."
"What island?"
Brianna, Ian and I all chorused together.
"Ocracoke," he said, looking surprised.
"It's the northmost portal in the Bermuda Triangle group. We wanted to be as close as we could get to..."
"The Bermuda..."
Brianna and I began, but broke off, looking at each other.
"You know where a number of these portals are?" I said, striving for calm.
"How many are there?" Brianna chimed in, not waiting for his answer. The answer, in any case, was confused.
No surprise there.
Raymond had told them that there were many such places in the world, but that they tended to occur in groups. There was such a group in the Caribbean, another in the northeast near the Canadian border, another in the southwestern desert, Arizona, he thought, and down through Mexico, northern Britain and the coast of France, as far as the tip of the Iberian Peninsula. Probably more, but that's all he'd mentioned. Not all of the portals were marked with stone circles, though those in places where people had lived for a long time tended to be.
"Raymond said those were safer," he said, shrugging. "I don't know why."
The spot on Ocracoke hadn't been bounded by a full circle of stones, though it was marked. "Four stones," he said. "One of them had marks on it, Raymond said, were African, maybe made by slaves." "It's kind of in the water," he said, shrugging. "A little stream runs through it, I mean. Ray said he didn't know about water and whether that made any difference, but he thought it might. But we didn't know what kind of difference. You guys know?" Brianna and I shook our heads, round-eyed as a pair of owls. Ian's brow, already furrowed, drew further down at this, though. Had he heard something during his time with Gillis Duncan? The five of them, and Raymond, had driven as far as they could. The road that led down the outer banks was a poor one, which tended to wash away in storms, and they were obliged to leave the car several miles away from the spot, struggling through the scrub pines of the coastal forest and patches of unexpected quicksand. It was late fall.
"Samhain," Brianna said, but softly enough that Donna wasn't distracted from the flow of his story.
"Late fall," he said, "and the weather was bad. It had been raining for days, and the footing was uncertain, slippery and boggy by turns. The wind was high, and the storm surge pounded the beaches. They could hear it, even in the secluded spot where the portal lay.
We were all scared, maybe all but Rob, but it was way exciting, man," he said, beginning to show a glimmer of enthusiasm. "The trees were just about laying down flat, and the sky, it was green. The wind was so bad you could taste salt all the time because little bits of ocean were flying through the air mixed with the rain. We were like salt through to our choners."
"Your what?"
Ian said, frowning. "Underpants, you know, drawers, small clothes," Brianna said, flapping an impatient hand. "Go on." Once arrived at the place, Raymond had checked them all to see that they carried the few necessities they might need. Tinder boxes, tobacco, a little money of the time, and then given each one a wampum necklet and a small leather pouch, which he said was an amulet of ceremonial herbs.
"Oh, you know about that," he said, seeing the expression on my face. "What kind did you use?"
"I didn't," I said, not wanting him to wander from his story.
"Go on.
How did you plan to hit the right time?"
"Oh, well," he sighed, hunching on his stool. "We didn't. Ray said it would be just about 200 years, give or take a couple. It wasn't like we could steer.
That's what I was hoping you guys would know, how to get to a specific time. Because, boy, I'd sure like to go back and get there before I got messed up with Ray and them. They had, at Raymond's direction, walked a pattern among the stones, chanting words. Donna had no idea what the words meant, or even what the language was. At the conclusion of the pattern, though, they had walked single file toward the stone with African markings, passing carefully to the left of it. And like, pow! He smacked a fist into the palm of his other hand. First guy in line is gone, man. We were just freaked out. I mean, that's what was supposed to happen, but... gone, he repeated, shaking his head. Just gone. Agog at this evidence of effectiveness, they had repeated the pattern and the chant, and at each repetition, the first man to pass the stone had vanished. Donna had been the fourth. Oh, God, he said, going pale at the memory. Oh, God, I never felt anything like that before, and I hope I never do again. The amulet, the pouch you had, Brianna said, ignoring his pallor. Her own face was intense, blazing with interest. What happened to that?
I don't know. I maybe dropped it. Maybe it went someplace else.
I passed out. And when I came to, it wasn't with me. The day was warm and close, but he began to shiver.
Jojo, he was with me. Only he was dead.
That statement struck me like a knife blow just under the ribs. Gillis Duncan's notebooks had held lists of people found near stone circles, some alive, some dead. I hadn't needed anything to tell me that the journey through the stones was a perilous passage, but this reminder made me feel weak in the knees, and I sat down on Jocasta's tufted ottoman. "The others," I said, trying to keep my voice steady. "Did they?" He shook his head. He was still clammy and shivering, but sweat glazed his face. He looked very unwell.
"Never saw him again," he said.
He didn't know what had killed Jojo, didn't pause to look, though he had a vague notion that there might have been burn marks on his shirt. Finding his friend dead, and none of the others nearby, he had stumbled off in a panic through scrub forest and salt marsh, collapsing after several hours of wandering, lying in the sand dunes among stiff grass all night. He had starved for 3 days, found and eaten a nest of turtle eggs, eventually made his way to the mainland on a stolen canoe, and thereafter had drifted haplessly, working here and there at menial jobs, seeking refuge in drink when he could afford it, falling into company with Hodgepile and his gang a year or so past. The wampum necklets, he said, were to allow the conspirators to identify each other should they meet at some point, but he had never seen anybody else wearing one. Brianna wasn't paying attention to this rambling part of the story, though. She had jumped ahead. "Do you think Ottertooth, Springer, screwed up your group by deliberately trying to go to a different time?" He looked at her, mouth hanging open a little.
"I never thought of that."
"He went first."
"He went first," he repeated, in a wondering sort of way.
Brianna began to ask another question, but was interrupted by the sound of voices in the hall, coming toward the morning room. Donna was on his feet in an instant, eyes wide with alarm.
"Crap," he said. "It's him. You got to help me."
Before I could inquire exactly why he thought so, or who him was, the austere form of Ulysses appeared in the doorway.
"You,"
he said to the cowering Donna in awful tones.
"Did I not tell you to be gone, sinner? How dare you to enter Mrs. Innie's house and pester her relations?"
He stepped aside then, with a nod to whomever stood beside him, and a small, round, cross-looking gentleman in a rumpled suit peered in.
"That's him," he said, pointing an accusatory finger. "That's the blackguard what stole my purse at Jacob's Ordinary this morning. Took it right out of my pocket whilst I was eating ham for breakfast."
"It wasn't me."
Donna made a poor attempt at a show of outrage, but guilt was written all over his face, and when Ulysses seized him by the scruff of the neck and unceremoniously rummaged his clothing, the purse was discovered, to the outspoken gratification of the owner.
"Thief!"
he cried, shaking his fist. "I've been a-following of you all the morning. Damn tick-bellied, louse-written, dog-eating savage! Oh, I do beg pardon, ladies," he added, bowing to me and Brianna as an afterthought before resuming his denunciation of Donna. Brianna glanced at me, eyebrows raised, but I shrugged. There was no way of preserving Donna from the righteous wrath of his victim, even had I really wanted to. At the gentleman's behest, Ulysses summoned a pair of grooms and a set of manacles, the sight of which made Brianna grow somewhat pale, and Donna was marched off, protesting that he hadn't done it. He'd been framed. Wasn't him. He was a friend of the lady's. Really, man, ask him. To be conveyed to the jail in Cross Creek. There was a deep silence in the wake of his removal. At last, Ian shook his head as though trying to rid himself of flies, and, putting down the palette knife at last, picked up the sketching book where Brianna had made Donna try to draw the pattern he said the men had walked. A hopeless scrawl of circles and squiggles. It looked like one of Jemmy's drawings.
"What kind of name is Wedigo?" Ian asked, putting it down.
Brianna had been clutching her pencil so tightly that her knuckles were white. She unfolded her hand and put it down, and I saw that her hands were shaking slightly.
"Wendigo," she said. "It's an Ojibwe cannibal spirit that lives in the wood. It howls in storms and eats people."
Ian gave her a long look.
"Nice fellow," he said.
"Wasn't he just..." I felt more than a little shaken myself. Apart from the shock of Donna's appearance and revelations, and then his arrest, small jolts of memory, vivid images of my first meeting with him, kept shooting uncontrollably through my mind, despite my efforts to shut them out. I could taste blood in my mouth, and the stink of unwashed men drowned the scent of flowers from the terrace.
"I suppose it's what one would call a nom de guerre," I said, with an attempt at nonchalance. "He can't have been christened that, surely."
"Are you all right, Mama?" Bree was frowning at me. "Shall I get something? A glass of water?"
"Whiskey," Ian and I said in unison, and I laughed, despite the shakiness.
By the time it arrived, I was in command of myself again.
"What do you think will happen to him, Ulysses?" I asked, as he held the tray for me.
The butler's stolidly handsome face showed nothing beyond a mild distaste for the recent visitor. I saw him frown at the scumbled bits of dirt that Donna's shoes had left on the parquet floor.
"I suppose they will hang him," he said. "Mr. Townsend, that was the gentleman's name, had 10 pounds in the purse he stole."
More than enough to merit hanging. The 18th century took a dim view of thievery. As little as a pound could incur a capital sentence.
"Good,"
said Ian, with obvious approval. I felt a small lurch of the stomach. I disliked Donna, distrusted him, and to be honest, really didn't feel that his death would be a great loss to humanity, by and large. But he was a fellow traveller. Did that impose any obligation on our part to help him? More importantly, perhaps, did he have any more information that he hadn't told us yet?
"Mr. Townsend has gone to Campbellton," the butler added, offering the tray to Ian, "to ask Mr. Farquhar to attend to the case promptly, as he is bound for Halifax and wishes to give his witness at once."
Farquhar Campbell was a justice of the peace, and likely the only thing approaching a judge within the county, since the circuit court had ceased to operate. "They won't hang him before tomorrow, though, I don't suppose," Brianna said. She didn't normally drink whiskey, but had taken a glass now. The encounter had shaken her, too. I saw she had turned the ring around upon her finger, rubbing the big ruby absent-mindedly with her thumb.
"No," said Ian, looking at her suspiciously. "You didn't mean to."
He glanced at me.
"No,"
he said in horror at the indecision he saw on my face.
"Yon fellow's a thief and a blackguard, and if you didna see him burning and killing with your own eyes, auntie,
You ken well enough he did it.
For God's sake, let them hang him and have done.
Well, I said, wavering. The sound of footsteps and voices in the hall saved me answering. Jamie and Duncan had been in Cross Creek. Now they were back. I felt an overwhelming flood of relief at the sight of Jamie, who loomed up in the doorway, sunburned and ruddy, dusty from riding.
"Hang who?" he inquired cheerfully.
Jamie's opinion was the same as Ian's.
Let them hang, Donna, and good riddance.
He was reluctantly persuaded that either Brianna or I must talk to the man at least once more, though, to be sure there was nothing further he could tell us.
"I'll speak to the jailer," he said, without enthusiasm.
"Mind, though," he pointed a monitory finger at me,
"neither of you is to go anywhere near the man, save Ian or I am with you."
"And what do you think he'd do?" Brianna was ruffled, annoyed at his tone. "He's about half my size, for heaven's sake."
"And a rattlesnake is smaller yet," her father replied. "You wouldn't walk into a room with one of those, only because you outweigh him, I hope."
Ian snickered at that, and Brianna gave him an elbow hard in the ribs.
"Anyway," Jamie said, ignoring them, "I've a bit of news. And a letter from Roger Mack," he said.
He pulled it out of his shirt, smiling at Bree.
"If you're no too distracted to read it."
She lit up like a candle and grabbed it. Ian made a teasing snatch at it, and she slapped his hand away, laughing, and ran out of the room to read it in privacy. "What sort of news?" I asked. Ulysses had left the tray and decanter. I poured a tot into my empty glass and gave it to Jamie.
"Someone's seen Manfred MacGillivray," he replied. "Slange."
He drained the glass, looking contented.
"Why? Where?"
Ian looked less than pleased at this news. For myself, I was thrilled.
"In a brothel? Where else?"
Unfortunately, his informant hadn't been able to supply the exact location of said brothel, having likely been too drunk at the time to know precisely where he was, as Jamie cynically observed, but had been reasonably sure that it was in Cross Creek, or Campbellton. Also, unfortunately, the sighting was several weeks old. Manfred might well have moved on. "It's a start, though," I said, hopeful. "Penicillin was effective, even against more advanced cases of syphilis, and I had some brewing in the winter kitchen even now. I'll go with you when you go to the jail. Then, after we've spoken with Donna, we can go look for the brothel." Jamie's look of contentment lessened appreciably.
"What? Why?"
"I didn't think Manfred would be still there, Auntie," Ian said, patently amused. "I doubt he'd have the money, for one thing." "Oh, ha, ha," I said. "He might have said where he was staying, mightn't he? Besides, I want to know whether he was showing any symptoms. In my own time, it might be 10, 20, or even 30 years after the appearance of the initial canker, before further syphilitic symptoms developed. In this time, though, syphilis was a much more fulminant disease. A victim could die within a year of infection. And Manfred had been gone for more than 3 months. God knew how long since he had first contracted the infection." Jamie looked distinctly unenthused about the idea of searching for brothels. Ian seemed rather more interested.
"I'll help look," he volunteered. "Fairgrass can come too. He kens a great deal about whores. They'd likely talk to him."
"Fergus? Fergus is here?"
"He is," Jamie said. "That was the other bit of news. He's paying his respects to my aunt at the moment."
"Why is he here, though?"
"Well, you heard the talk at the barbecue, eh? About Mr. Sims, the printer, and his troubles. It seems they've got worse, and he thinks of selling up before someone burns his shop to the ground and him in it. It struck me that perhaps it would suit Fergus and Massali better than the farming, so I sent word for him to come down and maybe have a word with Sims."
"That's a brilliant idea," I said. "Only, what would Fergus use for money to buy it?"
Jamie coughed and looked evasive.
Well, I imagine some sort of bargain might be struck, particularly if Sims is anxious to sell up.
All right, I said, resigned. I don't suppose I want to know the gory details. But Ian, I turned to him, fixing him with a beady eye. Far be it from me to offer you moral advice, but you are not, repeat, not, to be questioning Hawes in any deeply personal manner. Do I make myself clear?
Auntie, he said, pretending shock. The idea! But a broad grin spread across his tattooed face.
Chapter 56 Tar and Feathers. In the event, I let Jamie go alone to the jail to make arrangements for seeing Donna. He had assured me that this would be simpler without my presence, and I had several errands in Cross Creek. Besides the usual salt, sugar, pins, and other household goods needing replenishment, I urgently needed more cinchona bark for Lizzie. The Golbury ointment worked to treat malarial attacks, but wasn't nearly so effective as Jesuit bark in preventing them. The British trade restrictions were having their effect, though. There was, of course, no tea to be found. I'd expected that. There had been none for nearly a year. But neither was there any sugar, save at an exorbitant price, and steel pins weren't to be found at all. Salt I could get. With a pound of this in my basket, I made my way up from the docks. The day was hot and humid, away from the slight breeze off the river. The air was motionless and thick as treacle. The salt had solidified in its burlap bags, and the merchant had had to chip off lumps of it with a chisel. I wondered how Ian and Fergus were coming with their researches. I had a scheme in mind regarding the brothel and its inhabitants, but first we had to find it. I hadn't mentioned the idea to Jamie. If anything came of it, that would be time enough. A side street offered shade, in the form of a number of large elms that had been planted so as to overhang the street. I stepped into the welcome shadow of one of these, and found myself at the edge of the fashionable district, about 10 houses all told, of Cross Creek. From where I stood, I could see Dr. Fentiman's fairly modest abode, distinguished by a small hanging shingle decorated with a caduceus. The doctor wasn't in when I called, but his servant, a neat, plain young woman with badly crossed eyes, admitted me and showed me to the consulting room. This was a surprisingly cool and pleasant room, with large windows and a worn canvas cloth on the floor, painted in blue and yellow checkers, and furnished with a desk, two comfortable chairs, and a chaise longue on which patients might recline for examination. He had a microscope standing on the desk, through which I peered with interest. It was a fine one, though not quite so good as my own, I thought with some complacency. I was possessed of a strong curiosity about the rest of his equipment, and was debating with myself as to whether it would be an abuse of the doctor's hospitality to snoop through his cupboards, when the doctor himself arrived, borne on the wings of brandywine. He was humming a little tune to himself, and carrying his hat under one arm, his battered medical case in the crook of the other. Seeing me, he dropped these carelessly on the floor and hastened to grasp me by the hand, beaming. He bowed over my hand and pressed moistly fervent lips to my knuckles.
"Mrs. Fraser, my dear lady, I'm so pleased to see you. You are in no physical distress, I trust."
I was in some danger of being overwhelmed by the fumes of alcohol on his breath, but kept as cordial a countenance as possible, unobtrusively wiping my hand upon my gown, whilst assuring him that I was entirely well, as were all the members of my immediate family.
"Oh, splendid, splendid," he said,
plumping down quite suddenly upon a stool and giving me an enormous grin, revealing tobacco-stained molars. His oversized wig had slid round sideways, causing him to peer out from under it like a dormouse under a tea-cosy, but he seemed not to have noticed.
"Splendid, splendid, splendid."
I took his rather vague wave as invitation and sat down as well. I had brought a small present in order to sweeten the good doctor, and had now removed this from my basket. Though in all truth, I rather thought he was so well marinated as to require a little more attention before I broached the subject of my errand. He was, however, thrilled with my gift, a gouged-out eyeball, which young Ian had thoughtfully picked up for me following a fight in Yanceyville, hastily preserved in spirits of wine. Having heard something of Dr. Fentiman's tastes, I thought he might appreciate it. He did, and went on saying, "Splendid!" at some length. Eventually, trailing off, he blinked, held the jar up to the light, and turned it round, viewing it with great admiration. "Splendid!" he said once more. "It will have a most particularly honourable place in my collection, I do assure you, Mrs. Fraser." "You have a collection?" I said, affecting great interest. I'd heard about his collection.
Oh, yes. Would you care to see it?"
There was no possibility of refusal. He was already up and staggering toward a door at the back of his study. This proved to lead into a large closet, the shelves of which held 30 or 40 glass containers filled with alcoholic spirits, and a number of objects which could indeed be described as interesting. These ranged from the merely grotesque to the truly startling. One by one, he brought out a big toe sporting a wart the size and colour of an edible mushroom, a preserved tongue which had been split, apparently during the owner's lifetime, as the two halves were quite healed, a cat with 6 legs, a grossly malformed brain,
"removed from a hanged murderer," as he proudly informed me. "I shouldn't wonder," I murmured in reply, thinking of Donna and wondering what his brain might look like.
And several infants, presumably stillborn, and exhibiting assorted atrocious deformities.
"Now this," he said,
lifting down a large glass cylinder in trembling hands,
"is quite the prize of my collection. There is a most distinguished physician in Germany, a Herr Doktor Blumenbach, who has a world-renowned collection of skulls, and he has been pursuing me, nay, absolutely pestering me, I assure you, in an effort to persuade me to part with it."
This was the defleshed skulls and spinal column of a double-headed infant. It was, in fact, fascinating. It was also something that would cause any woman of childbearing age to swear off sex immediately. Grisly as the doctor's collection was, though, it offered me an excellent opportunity for approaching my true errand. "That is truly amazing," I said, leaning forward as though to examine the empty orbits of the floating skulls. They were separate and complete, I saw. It was the spinal cord that had divided, so that the skulls hung side by side in the fluid, ghostly white, and leaning toward each other, so that the rounded heads touched gently, as though sharing some secret, only separating when a movement of the jar caused them momentarily to float apart. I wonder what causes such a phenomenon.
"Oh, doubtless some dreadful shock to the mother," Dr. Fentiman assured me. "Women in an expectant condition are fearfully vulnerable to any sort of excitement or distress, you know. They must be kept quite sequestered and confined, well away from any injurious influences."
"I dare say," I murmured. "But, you know, some malformations, that one, for instance, I believe are the result of syphilis in the mother." It was. I recognised the typical malformed jaw, the narrow skull, and the caved-in appearance of the nose. This child had been preserved with flesh intact and lay curled placidly in its bottle. By the size and lack of hair, it had likely been premature. I hoped for its own sake that it hadn't been born alive.
Syphilis, the doctor repeated, swaying a little. "Oh, yes. I got that particular little creature from,
It occurred to him belatedly that syphilis was perhaps not a topic suitable to discuss with a lady. Murderer's brains and two-headed children, yes,
but not venereal disease. There was a jar in the closet that I was reasonably sure contained the scrotum of a Negro male who had suffered from elephantiasis. I noticed he hadn't shown me that one.
"From a prostitute?" I inquired sympathetically.
"Yes, I suppose such misfortunes must be common among such women." To my annoyance, he slithered away from the desired topic.
"No, no. In fact..."
He darted a look over his shoulder, as though fearing to be overheard, then leaned near me and whispered hoarsely,
"I received that specimen from a colleague in London some years ago. It is reputed to be the child of a foreign nobleman."
"Oh, dear," I said, taken aback. "How interesting." At this rather inconvenient point, the servant came in with tea, or rather with a revolting concoction of roasted acorns and chamomile stewed in water, and the conversation turned ineluctably toward social trivia. I was afraid that the tea might sober him up before I could inveigle him back in the right direction, but luckily the tea tray also included a decanter of fine claret, which I dispensed liberally. I had a fresh try at drawing him back into medical subjects by leaning over to admire the jars left out on his desk. The one nearest me contained the hand of a person who had had such an advanced case of Dupuytren's contracture as to render the appendage little more than a knot of constricted fingers. I wish Tom Christie could see it. He had avoided me since his surgery, but so far as I knew, his hand was still functional. "Isn't it remarkable the variety of conditions that the human body displays?" I said. He shook his head. He had discovered the state of his wig and turned it round. His wizened countenance beneath it looked like that of a solemn chimpanzee, bar the flush of broken capillaries that lit his nose like a beacon.
"Remarkable," he echoed. "And yet, what is quite as remarkable is the resilience a body may show in the face of quite terrible injury."
That was true, but it wasn't at all the line I wished to work upon. "Yes, quite, but..."
"I'm very sorry not to be able to show you one specimen. It would have been a notable addition to my collection, I assure you. But alas, the gentleman insisted upon taking it with him."
"He what?" Well, after all, I had in my time presented various children with their appendixes or tonsils in a bottle following surgery. I suppose it wasn't entirely unreasonable for someone to wish to retain an amputated limb.
"Yes, most astonishing."
He took a meditative sip of claret.
"A testicle it was. I trust you will pardon my mentioning it," he added belatedly.
He hesitated for an instant, but in the end simply couldn't resist describing the occurrence.
"The gentleman had suffered a wound to the scrotum, a most unfortunate accident."
"Most," I said, feeling a sudden tingle at the base of my spine. Was this Jocasta's mysterious visitor? I had been keeping off the claret in the interests of a clear head, but now poured a tot, feeling it needed. "Did he say how this unfortunate incident transpired?"
"Oh, yes. A hunting accident, he said. But they all say that, don't they?"
He twinkled at me, the end of his nose bright red.
"I expect it was a duello. The work of a jealous rival, perhaps?"
"Perhaps."
"A duello," I thought.
"But most duels of the time were fought with pistols, not swords." It really was good claret, and I felt a little steadier.
"You, removed the testicle."
"We must have, if he'd been contemplating adding it to his ghastly collection."
"Yes," he said,
and wasn't too far gone to give a small sympathetic shudder at the memory.
"The gunshot had been seriously neglected. He said it had occurred some days previous. I was obliged to remove the injured testicle, but fortunately preserved the other."
"I'm sure he was pleased about that." "Gunshot? Surely not," I was thinking. "It can't be. And yet, did this happen quite recently?"
"No.
He tilted back in his chair, eyes crossing slightly with the effort of recall.
It was in the spring, 2 years ago, May. Perhaps May.
Was the gentleman named Bonnet, by chance? I was surprised that my voice sounded quite casual. I believe I had heard that a Stephen Bonnet was involved in some such accident.
Well, you know, he wouldn't give his name. Often patients will not, if the injury is one that might cause public embarrassment. I do not insist in such cases.
But you do remember him. I found that I was sitting on the edge of my chair, claret cup clenched in my fist. With a little effort, I set it down. Damn, he was getting sleepy. I could see his lids begin to droop.
A tall gentleman, well-dressed. He had a most beautiful horse.
A bit more tea, Dr. Fentiman. I urged a fresh cup upon him, willing him to stay awake. Do tell me more about it. The surgery must have been quite delicate. In fact, men never like to hear that the removal of testicles is a simple matter, but it is. Though I would admit that the fact of the patient's being conscious during the whole procedure had likely added to the difficulty. Fentiman regained a bit of his animation, telling me about it. And the ball had gone straight through the testicle. It had left the most perfect hole. You could look quite through it, I assure you. Plainly he regretted the loss of this interesting specimen, and it was with some difficulty that I got him to tell me what had become of the gentleman to whom it belonged.
Well, that was odd. It was the horse, you see,
he said vaguely.
Lovely animal. Long hair, like a woman's. So unusual.
A Frisian horse. The doctor had recalled that the planter, Philip Wiley, was fond of such horses, and had said as much to his patient, suggesting that as the man had no money, and wouldn't be capable of riding comfortably for some time in any case, he might think of selling his animal to Wiley. The man had agreed to this, and had requested the doctor to make inquiry of Wiley, who was in town for the court sessions. Dr. Fentiman had obligingly gone out to do so, leaving his patient cosily tucked up on the chaise with a draught of tincture of laudanum. Philip Wiley had professed himself most interested in the horse.
Yes, I'll wager he was, I said,
but the doctor didn't notice, and had hastened round to see it. The horse was present, but the patient was not, having absconded on foot in the doctor's absence, taking with him half a dozen silver spoons, an enamelled snuff-box, the bottle of laudanum, and 6 shillings, which happened to be all the money the doctor had in the house.
I cannot imagine how he managed it, Fentiman said, eyes quite round at the thought. In such condition.
To his credit, he appeared more distressed at the notion of his patient's condition than his own loss. He was a terrible drunkard, Fentiman, I thought. I'd never seen him completely sober. But not a bad doctor.
Still, he added philosophically, all's well as ends well, is it not, my dear lady?
By which he meant that Philip Wiley had purchased the horse from him for a price sufficient to more than compensate for his losses and leave him with a tidy profit. Quite, I said, wondering just how Jamie would take this news. He had won the stallion, for it must, of course, be Lucas, from Philip Wiley, in the course of an acrimonious card game at River Run, only to have the horse stolen by Stephen Bonnet a few hours later. On the whole, I expected that Jamie would be pleased that the stallion was back in good hands, even if they weren't his. As for the news about Bonnet,
a bad penny always turns up,
had been his cynical opinion expressed when Bonnet's body had failed to be discovered after Brianna had shot him. Fentiman was openly yawning by now. He blinked, eyes watering, patted about his person in search of a handkerchief, then bent to rummage in his case, which he had dropped on the floor near his chair. I had pulled out my own handkerchief and leaned across to hand it to him, when I saw them in the open case.
"What are those?" I asked, pointing. I could see what they were, of course. What I wanted to know was where he'd got them.
They were syringes, two of them, lovely little syringes made of brass. Each one was composed of two bits, a plunger with curled handles, and a cylindrical barrel drawn out at the narrowed end into a very long, blunt-tipped needle. He was terribly taken aback and stammered like a schoolboy caught sneaking cigarettes behind the toilets. Then something occurred to him, and he relaxed.
"Ears," he declared in ringing tones, "for cleansing ears. Yes, that is what they are, indubitably. Ear clisters."
"Oh, are they really?" I picked one up. He tried to stop me, but his reflexes were delayed, and he succeeded only in grabbing at the ruffle of my sleeve. "How ingenious," I said, working the plunger. It was a little stiff, but not bad at all, particularly not when the alternative was a makeshift hypodermic composed of a leather tube with a rattlesnake's fang attached. Of course, a blunt tip wouldn't do, but it would be a simple matter to cut it to a sharp angle. "Where did you get them? I should like very much to order one myself." He stared at me in abject horror, jaw agape.
I really do not think," he protested feebly.
Just then, in a perfect miracle of bad timing, his housemaid appeared in the doorway.
"Mr. Brennan's come. It's his wife's time," she said briefly.
"Oh."
Dr. Fentiman leapt to his feet, slammed shut his case, and snatched it up.
"My apologies, dear Mrs. Fraser. Must go. Matter of great urgency. So pleasant to have seen you."
He rushed out, case clutched to his bosom, stepping on his hat in his haste. The maid picked up the crushed chapeau with an air of resignation and punched it indifferently back into shape.
"Will you be wanting to leave now, ma'am?"
she inquired, with an intonation making it clear that I ought to be leaving, whether I wanted to or not.
"I will," I said, rising. "But tell me," I held out the brass syringe on the palm of my hand, "do you know what this is, and where Dr. Fentiman got it?"
It was difficult to tell in which direction she was looking, but she bent her head as though to examine it with no more interest than had it been a two-day-old smelt offered her for sale in the market.
"Oh, that? Aye, ma'am. It's a penis syringe. I believe he had it sent him from Philadelphia."
"Penis syringe? I see," I said, blinking a little.
"Yes, ma'am. It's for treating of the drip or the clap. The doctor does a deal of business for the men what goes to Mrs. Sylvie's."
I took a deep breath.
"Mrs. Sylvie's? Ah,
and would you know where Mrs. Sylvie's establishment is?"
"Behind Silas Jameson's ordinary," she replied, giving me for the first time a faintly curious look, as though wondering what sort of blockhead didn't know that. "Will you be needing anything else, ma'am?"
"Oh, no," I said. "That will do nicely, thank you." I made to hand her back the penis syringe, but then was struck by impulse. The doctor had two, after all.
"Give you a shilling for it," I said, meeting the eye that seemed most likely to be pointed in my direction.
"Done," she said promptly. She paused for a moment, then added,
"If you're going to use it on your man, best be sure he's dead drunk first."
My primary mission was thus accomplished, but now I had a new possibility to explore before mounting an assault on Mrs. Sylvie's house of ill repute. I had planned to visit a glassmaker and attempt to explain, by means of drawings, how to make the barrel and plunger for a hypodermic syringe, leaving up to Bree the problem of making a hollow needle and attaching it. Unfortunately, while the single glass blower operating in Cross Creek was capable of producing any manner of everyday bottles, jugs, and cups, a glance at his stock had made it obvious that my requirements were well beyond his capabilities. But now I needn't worry about that.
While metal syringes lacked some desirable qualities of glass, they also had an undeniable advantage, insofar as they wouldn't break. And while a disposable needle was nice, I could simply sterilize the entire item after each use. Dr. Fentiman's syringes had very thick, blunt-tipped needle ends. It would be necessary to heat them and draw the tips out much further in order to narrow them. But any idiot with a forge could do that, I thought. Then to cut the brass tip at an angle and file the points smooth enough to puncture skin cleanly. Child's play, I thought blithely, and narrowly refrained from skipping down the sandy walk. Now all I required was a good stock of cinchona bark. My hopes of obtaining the bark were dashed, though, as soon as I turned into the main street and glimpsed Mr. Bogue's apothecary's shop. The door stood open, letting in flies, and the usually immaculate stoop was marred with such a multitude of muddy footprints as to suggest that some hostile army had descended upon the shop. The impression of sacking and looting was furthered by the scene inside. Most of the shelves were empty, scattered with remnants of dried leaf and broken pottery. The Bogues's 10-year-old daughter, Miranda, stood mournful watch over a small collection of jars and bottles and an empty tortoiseshell. "Miranda," I said, "whatever has happened?" She brightened at sight of me, small pink mouth momentarily reversing its downward droop. "Mrs. Fraser, do you want some horehound? We've nearly a pound of that left, and it's cheap. Only 3 farthings the ounce." "I'll have an ounce," I said, though in fact I had plenty growing in my own garden. "Where are your parents?" The mouth went down again, and the lower lip quivered. "Mama's in the back packing, and Papa's gone to sell Jack to Mr. Raintree." Jack was the apothecary's wagon horse, and Miranda's particular pet. I bit the inside of my lip. "Mr. Raintree's a very kind man," I said, striving for what comfort there might be, "and he has a nice pasture for his horses and a warm stable. I think Jack might be happy there. He'll have friends." She nodded, mouth pinched tight, but 2 fat tears escaped to roll down her cheeks. With a quick glance behind me to assure that no one was coming in, I stepped round the counter, sat down on an upturned keg, and drew her onto my lap, where she melted at once, clinging to me and crying, though making an obvious effort not to be heard in the living quarters behind the shop. I patted her and made small, soothing noises, feeling on her knees beyond mere sympathy for the girl. Clearly, the Bogueses were selling up. Why? So infrequently, as I came down the mountain, I had no idea what Ralston Bogues's politics might be these days. Not being Scottish, he hadn't come to the barbecue in Flora MacDonald's honour. The shop had always been prosperous, though, and the family decently off, judging by the children's clothes. Miranda and her 2 little brothers always had shoes. The Bogueses had lived here all of Miranda's life, at least, and likely longer. For them to be leaving in this manner meant that something serious had happened, or was about to. "Do you know where you're going?" I asked Miranda, who was now sitting on my knee, sniffing and wiping her face on my apron. "Perhaps Mr. Raintree can write to you, to tell you how Jack is faring." She looked a little more hopeful at that. "Can he send a letter to England, do you think? It's a terrible long way."
"England?" It was serious.
"Oh, I should think so," I said, tucking wisps of hair back under her cap. "Mr. Fraser writes a letter every night to his sister in Scotland, and that's much further away even than England."
"Oh, well."
Looking happier, she scrambled off my lap and smoothed down her dress.
"Can I write to Jack, do you think?"
"I'm sure Mr. Raintree will read the letter to him if you do," I assured her. "Can you write well, then?"
"Oh, yes, ma'am,"
she said earnestly. "Papa says I read and write better than he ever did when he was my age, and in Latin. He taught me to read all the names of the simples, so I could fetch him what he wanted. See that one?" She pointed with some pride to a large china apothecary's jar, elegantly decorated with blue and gold scrolls.
Electuary limonensis, and that one is ipecacuanha.
I admired her prowess, thinking that at least I now knew her father's politics. The Bogueses must be loyalists if they were returning to England. I would be sorry to see them go, but knowing what I knew of the immediate future, I was glad that they would be safe. At least Ralston would likely have got a decent price for his shop. A short time hence, loyalists would have their property confiscated and be lucky to escape arrest, or worse.
Randy, have you seen George's shoe? I found one under the chest, but... Oh, Mrs. Fraser, your pardon, ma'am. I didn't know anyone was here.
Melanie Bogues's sharp glance took in my position behind the counter, her daughter's pink ribbon.